Today on the 21st, our summer reading series continues with a focus on Illinois books and authors. We'll talk with a librarian and a writer and editor from Central Illinois.
Illinois is a long state, which makes it geographically and culturally diverse. Writers from the top of Illinois to the bottom of Illinois are usually completely different, and at the same time share a lot of the same things that the state has for writers.
As Pokemon Go continues to gain popularity, it should come as no surprise that businesses, organizations, even churches are trying to capitalize on the game's success.
You would have some people that would automatically see that it's a welcome table and they would sit down and they would converse with us. Others, they looked a little skeptical. I think they were afraid that we were going to pull them in for a communion or something of that fact. But, you know, we said, look, we're just here just offering friendship and hospitality to those in the Champaign community who are playing Pokemon Go.
I'm Brian Moline, Illinois Books and Authors Past and Present, and cashing in on Pokemon Go today on the 21st. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. Every other Friday this summer, we've been talking about reading and speaking to librarians and writers, plus hearing your suggestions to create summer reading lists. We kick things off with a general list. We've talked about kids' books, political books, and even guilty pleasures. Now we thought we'd turn our focus to authors from Illinois and books about Illinois. Illinois has a long literary history. Some books that come to mind might be Upton Sinclair's The Jungle or Richard Wright's Native Son. And it's a history that continues into the present day with authors like Dave Eggers and Urbana's Richard Powers. But it's not a uniform history. The writing of Illinois authors reflects the differences in the geography and culture, from urban to rural, northern to southern, prairie to lakes and rivers all over the state. Joining us in the studio are Joel Shoemaker, the director of the Oakwood Public Library District in Oakwood, just west of Danville, and Jason Lee Brown. He's a novelist. His latest book is Championship Run. He's also the editor of the anthology New Stories from the Midwest. Joel Shoemaker and Jason Lee Brown, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Listeners, if you have any recommendations for summer books with Illinois ties, feel free to give us a call at 800-222-9455, or you can tweet them to us at 21st Show. For both of you, Jason, I'll start with you. The history of Illinois literature is a pretty long one. Compiling a list of authors is a good reminder of the variety of people who've hailed from the state or moved here and wrote here or even just lived here briefly. Can we get maybe a brief reminder of some Illinois writers that we might not even remember that have ties to the state?
Well, I think there's a lot of writers who, you know, lived here and then moved away. I would say probably Hemingway is the most famous. You know, a lot of people say he's a Midwestern writer, but I don't necessarily consider him a Midwestern writer because he didn't really write about the Midwest. He just grew up here and then left. But I'd say he's probably the most famous one.
Sure. Joel, how about you? Some writers that come to mind maybe that people don't think of off the top of their head when they think of Illinois authors.
Well, my experience is mostly in middle school literature. So my favorite would be the Kleiss family from Peoria, Illinois. They're a very talented family. The mother just passed away but still lived in Peoria until that time. And then all of the children have moved away, but they still do write about Illinois from time to time.
Before we kind of get into lists of books for people here this summer, Jason, you recently wrote a novel called Prowler, the Mad Gasser of Mattoon. It's a novel based on a historical event in Mattoon. Give us a little background on that story, if you could.
Well, in 1944, in Mattoon, Illinois, this is pretty much at the end of World War II, one person thought that they were gassed, that somebody sprayed some gas in a window, and the newspaper, the headline said, Mad Gasser takes first victim, and I think the word first implies there were going to be more. So for the next 2 weeks, people in Mattoon were saying that they were being gassed. Later on, a couple years later, reporters from Time magazine come down, and psychologists basically call it the perfect case study of mass hysteria. So one person thinks something happens and they think it's going to happen to them. There was also a lot of women who were home alone because a lot of their husbands were serving in war. I think maybe that helped cause it. But I was just interested in it from working at the newspaper and being someone who's born and raised in Central Illinois. It's a story that's been around, and I wanted to know, you know, what were the facts compared to the myths and everything like that.
So how did you take the accounts of that story that you found in newspapers, magazines, et cetera, and turn it into a novel?
I went to the Mattoon Library and went through the microfilm. And the Mattoon Library were great. They just basically let me go in and out anytime I wanted. So I would go and look up every single incident that happened in that 2 weeks. And then I wrote them all down and framed it for that. And then once I started writing, then I'd start fictionalizing it and taking the characters, giving them motivation and backgrounds of why this is happening. Hmm.
Very interesting. Again, that's called Prowler, the Mad Gasser of Mattoon, if you want to check that out. I'm curious, this one for both of you, and Joel, I'll start with you. How would you define or can you define an Illinois style of writing?
I can't. Most of the authors that I have experience with that came from the state write about not Illinois all the time, and the writing is very, I would say, dialogue in plays that I'm familiar with. There is a Midwestern dialect and a dialogue specifically in Mamet and Letts plays, David Mamet and Tracy Letts plays. Mm-hmm. So I would say dialogue is easier for me as a reader to note, oh, this is about or by an Illinois author.
Sure. And Jason, how about you? And any kind of a style that you think kind of unifies literature in Illinois?
I've had a lot of discussions about, like, the dialogue and what, you know, do we have a specific sound here? And normally the Midwest is considered what is the, you know, default dialect that we have. So it's not like Southern language where you can throw that into the dialogue a lot easier. And I think it's a lot harder to write Midwestern Illinois dialogue. But, again, I just think it's so varied here in Illinois and the Midwest that it's all over the map, and I think that's one of the things I like about Midwest and Illinois writing.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about it in the opening. You've got such diverse geography in the state. You've got diverse culture from Chicago to agriculture to southern Illinois, where it's more lakes, rivers, woods. I would imagine all of that contributes to a very diverse set of literature in the state.
Yes, the north part of Illinois and the southern part of Illinois are completely different lands, different people, different settings, just, you know, topography is completely different. And I think that makes a difference in what you write about and how you write.
And Jason, I'm curious how that affected you when you were studying literature. Any impressions you had growing up, things that you read early in life that maybe, you know, affected your study of literature?
Ooh, that's a big question. I could probably talk for about 3 hours on. There are stories and people from Illinois who are Illinois writers that I read when I was younger that I thought, he's writing about things I want to write about and areas I want to write about, and he's doing it really well. Philip Deaver is one. He's from he's from Tuscola. He had a story called Arcola Girls that was anthologized in O'Henry and some other things. And the first time I read it, he just has one of these little, and I haven't read it for years, but I can still remember, he has a line about the little black seams in the highway when the car's going down and thumping it. And I just thought, what a great little detail that, you know, I live here, I didn't think of that. And those things are the things I think that get me fired up as a writer more than anything.
Sure. And for you, Joel, your background a little bit more on the drama side of things. What about you? Some things that you read that you maybe acted as you were growing up here in the state. How did that impact you as you continued your study of literature and drama?
Gosh, I really don't know. I think as far as the Illinois connection is concerned, for acting, lack of a dialect, lack of an accent, and that sort of thing. That is kind of difficult, depending on what characters you're trying to portray. And I haven't had a lot of experience acting someone specifically from Illinois, but that is always a concern as an actor.
Sure. And I'm curious for you as well, Joel. Some ties between literature and playwriting for you. You serve as a librarian there in Oakwood. You're active as an actor and as a director. You're about to direct the play August, Osage County by Tracy Letts over in Danville. Mm-hmm. How do the two really tie together for you?
Well, I mean, plays are literature. Plays are books. Plays can be read, and it's a different format of reading. It's sort of akin to a graphic novel, sort of a digest format, easier to read. Certainly. And so that excites me. And a reluctant reader that comes into my library might take well to a script. So we do have those in the library that are available. Moreover, I mean, it's a different medium entirely. And so it's fun to see a play come to life. And it's fun to read the script either before or after to note the differences or the things that you might have missed, stage directions that are written in and that sort of thing.
Sure. And, you know, there are, of course, writers who've kind of crossed over into both genres. David Mamet has done, known, of course, for his plays, and some of those have been made into movies like Glengarry Glen Ross, but he's best known as a playwright, but he's also written some novels. Are there any other Illinois authors you can think of who've kind of done that, something similar, where they're maybe best known in one genre or another, but have also made a name for them in the other?
I mentioned Tracy Letts briefly. He's from Oklahoma, but he spent over a decade now working at Steppenwolf. He's very Chicago, I would say, at this mm-hmm. point, and he has written many plays. And he's also written the screenplays for some of his movies as well. So those are the two that I'm most familiar with.
Sure. Let's talk about some current favorites. What are some books right now with Illinois ties that you've recently taken a look at? Jason, we'll start with you. What are some that really stand out to you right now?
The book I want to read right now that I just haven't gotten is from Lee Martin. He is just a magnificent literary citizen. The guy is just a really nice guy, and he's got a new book out called Late One Night, and I just haven't had the chance to pick it up and read it. But right now, I think that's probably first on my list that I haven't read. For ones that I have read, I mean, I could probably go on and on forever. The 100-Year House by Rebecca Mackay is a really good book. She's a really good writer, and she's from Chicago area. That came out a couple years ago. It's a really good book. I could do this all day.
Sure.
I'm obsessed with Illinois writers, and especially Central Illinois writers or Southern Illinois writers, because I am one of those, and it's not that we have contention with the Chicago writers, but they're a little bit different than Chicago writers and Central Illinois writers and Southern mm-hmm. Illinois writers.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Let's just delve into a couple of those here real quick. Lee Martin's book, you said you haven't read it yet, but what about Lee Martin stands out to you? You mentioned, you know, great guy, great person in the world of literature, but what about Lee Martin's writing really stands out to you, Jason?
Well, he's from Central Illinois. He's from kind of Southern Central Illinois. And again, he writes about things that I wanted to write about when I was younger, and he does it really well. So when he's writing about his home county in Illinois, I relate to that. More than anything, I think it's the writers that are doing things really well that make me upset about me not doing that as a writer. And writers who do that, I tend to gravitate towards.
Sure. And the other one you just mentioned, Rebecca Mackay's The 100-Year House. What about that novel really makes it appealing to you?
Her sentences and her writing are just beautiful. I would say that's one of the things Rebecca does the most for me is just as a writer, it's fun to read her sentences.
Very good. And Joel, for you, what are some books you're recommending? You mentioned your focus tends to be a little more in the middle school level, the young adult level. What are some things you're recommending for readers this summer?
Sure. I can speak to two authors that come from Central Illinois. The first would be Linda Sue Park. She actually is from Urbana. And it seems like she maybe got a late start with publishing, taking on a few different careers before she got to authoring novels and picture books. She may be most known for the book A Single Shard, which won a Newbery. The book that I put on the list merely because I was able to read it really quickly and speak to it with a little bit more authority. But there is a great picture book that is called The Firekeeper's Son by Linda Sue Park. And I think picture books are great. I think they're great for all ages. And especially like ones like this, which she's from Urbana. She's Korean and Korean-American. And she this is a piece of historical fiction. It talks about the fact that in older times, they set fires so that the king knew that all was clear in the land. And one would set a fire, and then they would see the fire, and then set the next fire, and you know, on and on. And so, this is about one of the firekeepers who hurt himself and couldn't get to the fire. So his son kind of tries to come to the rescue, and it's thrilling, really. And the other one that's from the Central Illinois region that I would recommend is Rebecca Cottle. She's an older writer, mm-hmm. and so her books are going to provide more of a historical perspective. But she has great ties to Illinois. In fact, our Young Reader Award is called the Rebecca Cottle Award, and I think she's the one that I learned while researching for this show that, yeah, she was on the Board of Trustees at the Urbana Free Library once upon a time, which I think is pretty cool. So yeah. I specifically put Tree of Freedom on the list. She's got quite a few, and they should be widely available.
Very good. We'll continue our discussion on summer reading books that have Illinois ties. If you have any recommendations for this summer, feel free to give us a call at 800-222-9455. You can also find us on Twitter at 21st Show. We're discussing Illinois books for summer reading with Joel Shoemaker and Jason Lee Brown. Feel free to jump into the conversation as the 21st Show continues. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline. We're talking about summer books with Illinois ties with Joel Shoemaker, the director of the Oakwood Public Library District, and Jason Lee Brown, novelist and editor of New Stories from the Midwest. If you have any recommendations for summer reading with Illinois ties, feel free to call in at 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show. We did get a tweet from Betsy. She recommends William Maxwell's So Long, See You Tomorrow. Thanks for that recommendation, Betsy. Jason, we mentioned you're the editor of the anthology News Stories from the Midwest. How long have you been involved with that?
I created the anthology, well, I tried to do it in grad school, and I think that was around 2008. But the first one didn't come out for a couple years later. I kind of tweaked it and then found a press who was interested in it, and then that's how it started. So I've been doing it for 5 or 6 years now.
And when's the new edition due out?
The new one is supposed to be out in October, but I'm guessing probably December. We're pushing it back a little bit. The press that I'm publishing it with is doing companion anthologies, so they're starting a new poetry from the Midwest and a new nonfiction from the Midwest, and we're trying to make sure we have all three scheduled in the way we want. So the next one should be out at the end of this year, and I'm really proud of it. It's a really good collection.
Any authors of note in this year's collection?
There's all kinds. I don't have my list on me, but let's see here. Stuart Dybeck is one, Charles Baxter. I'm having a hard time thinking off the top of my head right now. But those two, I would say, are kind of well-known in the literary world, even though they're not commercially well-known.
Sure. Let's talk a little bit more about some recommendations that you both passed on to us for this summer. Joel, one on your list and one that seems particularly timely right now is Dick Van Dyke, with him making a return to Danville this year. He has a book called My Lucky Life, In and Out in Show Business, a memoir. What stands out to you about Mr. Van Dyke's memoir?
Well, he's very generous, and he's his life is really is really fascinating, and he's all over Danville. And what's most interesting to me is how proud he is of that. And I think that's fantastic. And so, you know, just coming back just a few weeks ago, and that was solely to raise money for his childhood home. Mm-hmm. And he was very generous with his time here, hanging out with kids, and they put on two shows, and he attended both of those, and stayed at Sleepy Creek, the winery just down the street from my library, which mm-hmm. was great. And people would walk in and had no idea that he was there and was like, oh my gosh. And it was very cool. And his whole life is like that for me, and sure. And his career, and the book is reflective of that, I think.
Sure. Did you get a chance to see him when he was in town?
I didn't. The shows, I think they sold out in like 5 minutes or something ridiculous. I actually wanted to, and it was weird because you could only get tickets in person, and then, like I said, they were gone. And one of my trustees at the library hosted him at Sleepy Creek, which is pretty cool. So he was in charge of his whole visit there, basically. So
sure. And again, the title of that is My Lucky Life In and Out of Show Business, a memoir by Dick Van Dyke. An author with Illinois ties who's become very well known is Dave Eggers. One of the books on your list is a heartbreaking work of staggering genius. When you think of Dave Eggers as an author, Jason, what really stands out to you?
The books I've read, as he's always dropping little, it's like, here's Rantoul in it, and here's Champagne. There's always little references of Central Illinois in it, which is always interesting, like I said, when I was growing up. But the heartbreaking work of staggering genius is a mix of fiction and nonfiction. He just broke boundaries with it. I think that's why it becomes so popular, and you know what he's writing about and everything like that.
Sure. Of course, he attended University of Illinois here, and his life itself is just a very interesting story as well.
Yes, and he started McSweeney's and a publishing company, and you know, took a different route through publishing, and I'm a fan of all that as well.
Very good. So yeah, Dave Eggers, definitely one to check out from the state of Illinois. A book I think that you have with you today, Joel, is Graham Moore's Chicago, yeah. Last Days of Night. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about this one.
This is a great book. I just reviewed it for the News Gazette, and it's out next week, actually. So it's interesting. My copy is an advanced reader copy that says that it's on sale September 20th, but I know for a fact, because I bought it promptly for my library, that it comes out next week, and I can't wait. Graham Moore is a cool guy. He's from the Chicago area, and his first book was The Sherlockian, and which is obviously a Sherlock Holmes thing. After that, he took a very long break to write the screenplay for The Imitation Game, which, of course, he won an Academy Award for. And so this book, both of those things are just very intelligent, very just smart reading, great reading. So this book, for that reason, intimidated me a little bit. And so I wasn't even sure. It's over 500 pages, I think. But it's very quick chapters and fascinating. I actually heard him speak about it. And he was, I guess, shocked that there was little coverage of the Westinghouse scandal. And so he put a twist on it. And it's all about who invented the light bulb, which is a weird, seems like a weird premise for such a dense novel, but it reads very light and it's very fun. There's even a little bit of romance and a lot of mystery, and it basically intertwines Westinghouse with Nikola Tesla, who apparently was a character, mm-hmm. and Edison, of course, and who could turn in the patent first, and then everybody was suing everyone, and so the central character of this novel is attorney Paul Kravath or Kravath or something, and it's historical fiction, so all of those people are real, and it's cool because at the end of the book he discusses which parts are real, which mm-hmm. parts are fiction. It's a great book.
Yeah, historical fiction is such an interesting genre. You can do so many different things with it. I'm curious from both of your perspectives, what really makes an effective historical novel? And Joel, I'll start with you. What does a historical novel really need to have to make it work?
Well, for me, I mean, again, with my experience being mostly middle grade, before I was a public librarian, I was a middle school librarian, and, you know, to get kids interested in a book, but even for this one, too, so I mean, my limited experience with adult books as well, historical fiction has the real challenge to me of being both factual and interesting. So that's where the style of writing has to come in, and that's where brief chapters are helpful, illustrations are helpful, because, you know, there's a different person is reading a piece of historical fiction than is reading a historical nonfiction. And those are two very different types of books. And so for me, a good historical piece of historical fiction needs to have that entertainment value.
Sure. And Jason, how about you? What makes a really good historical novel for you?
I think it's the same that makes up any good book for me or any reading, if it's just an article or whatever it is. And I get this question a lot for the anthology when I'm reading them. What are you looking for and stuff like that? And what I always tell people is that, one, it has to be emotionally engaging to me. You have to emotionally engage me somehow with your writing. And then it has to be entertaining, and that can be in many ways, depending. I mean, that could, you know, even for poetry, you can entertain me in some way. But for those two things, that's what I want the most out of when I'm reading. As a writer writing one, that's a different story, how far you can push it. I mean, you're using actual names that are still around in the town. And when I was doing readings over there, you're running into these people. And when I was writing, and I was conscious of, you know, those aspects of it. So that made it a little different. But as a reader, those are the two things I want the most.
Sure. I'm curious, you mentioned, you know, some of the challenges of that as an author writing in that genre. What was maybe the most awkward situation you ran into when you were dealing with people whose families were actually, you know, being mentioned in your book?
Given the background and the motivations to what they're doing, because, you know, there's the fiction part of it. I mean, the incidents that were happening, I mean, I took those straight out of the newspaper. So people will read those and think, well, this is the real part. And then they don't know what the fiction part is and what's not. But at the same time, I kind of like that. I think that's a lot of times what, you know, historical fiction is good at is blending those things together.
Another example is perhaps Devil in the White City, set in Chicago by Eric Larson. And that one, you're dealing with a serial killer in the World's Fair. Just a very interesting work in and of itself.
I love the end of that book. I think I like the more of the narrative part of it than the research, which he's just amazing at. I mean, his research is so in-depth and ridiculous that it puts other people to shame sometimes. But I still think I like the narrative part more at the end when he's talking about the detective and what they're doing and trying to. I found that the most entertaining. Sometimes the information bogs me down, but I have friends who just love that. They cannot get enough of putting that stuff in. So I think he does a really good job of balancing those two things.
Definitely. Another author from Urbana who's certainly very well known, David Foster Wallace. How familiar are both of you with his work and any particular works of his that you'd recommend?
I've read a lot more of his political stuff. Mm-hmm. I feel like he was doing things with that was really good when he was doing it. Now, I've never read Infinite Jest. It would take me probably...
Isn't that huge?
It's really big. Yeah. And I've known people who have tackled it and, you know, call it rewarding and everything. You know, he's a genius, so I'm not. And sometimes he loses me with some of his writing. That's not saying it's bad or anything, for sure. But I think that's probably the thing that I take from him the most, is that he's so smart and sometimes he gets away from me.
Very good. We're talking about summer reading today with books and authors with Illinois ties. If you have any recommendations, 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show. Joel, back to you. Another author with Illinois ties who grew up in Barrington is Veronica Roth. Her series Divergent certainly has done very well. What has made that series such a success at the young adult level?
Sure. Veronica Roth is so great dystopia. And I think I don't want to. I'm sure that the books by themselves are great, but I also think it's a blessing of timing. And the series Dystopia is and or was everywhere, depending on how you look at it now, how you look at what's trending in YA. But Divergent, of course, those novels are particularly interesting for us as librarians at this time because they were turned into movies and now they're going to TV and so straight to TV. And so there's talk about making a miniseries out of them or something. But it's just interesting because, you know, we love seeing books turned into movies because it rejuvenates interest in the book, whether the adaptation is great or not. I think that is interesting. And I think that those books, kids love them because they need something after they're done with The Hunger Games. And those really work.
Yeah, so they continue to be very popular.
Absolutely. People are asking for them all the time. And I think there's four in the Divergent series, if I'm not mistaken. And I think that she's currently developing something else as well, which I'm sure will be greatly popular.
On a different tone, let's look a little bit at Southern Illinois. A book you recommend, Jason, by Paul Angle, Bloody Williamson, A Chapter in American Lawlessness. Williamson County, down in the southern part of the state, really has quite a history, doesn't it?
Yes, there was a lot of shooting and fighting, and after the Great Depression hit, and then also the illegal booze running, I guess, also helped that feud. It's also one of those books that I read when I was a lot younger that I just thought, wow, these people are writing about areas I know, and this is really interesting. And really, what I would say is it's the Al Capone version of Southern Illinois to the northern part of Illinois.
Okay, very good. That's by Paul Angle, called Bloody Williamson, A Chapter in American Lawlessness, published way back in 1952, so it's been around a long time, but continues to have staying power.
Yes, and it's being published more. I mean, it's been several publications through, you know, how many times they've redone it, and it's still, people are still buying it today.
Back to the younger literature. You mentioned the Kleisses from Peoria.
Yeah.
Let's give a few examples of some of the work that they've published that made your list here.
Sure. Kate Kleiss's books are great because they're, well, for a lot of reasons, but they're illustrated by her sister, which is awesome. And so, and basically a lot of them are like letter-based because that's how they actually put them together. Like Kate will write a book and then she'll send it to California and Sarah will illustrate it and it goes back and forth like that, which is pretty cool. Kate Kleiss is a friend of mine at this point, or I will refer to her as my friend because I was working in Peoria and I found her books and I asked her to speak to my school. And not only did she do that twice, but she also found out that her mother also used to teach at that school. And so that was a fun tie as well. And she actually just visited my library in Oakwood last month. And her books are great because they teach a lot, actually. So parents can look forward to giving them to children. Teachers should look forward to giving them to children. Several of them teach math in the books, which is really rare, and it's very well done. They're filled with letters and newspapers, and she's just now written over 30 books, one and or been nominated for over 100 awards. Very well written. I would say the series that I would recommend would be The Three Ring Rascals.
Very good. So some great recommendations here today from Joel Shoemaker, the director of the Oakwood Public Library District, and Jason Lee Brown, novelist and editor of News Stories from the Midwest. Joel and Jason, thank you very much for joining us today on the 21st.
Thank you. I'm a huge fan of this show. I really like it. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, filling in for Nyla Boodoo. Since it was released 2 months ago, Pokemon Go has been generating excitement across the globe and also here in Illinois, of course. It has more daily users than Twitter, and downloads on Android devices have recently just exceeded 100 million. So it should come as no surprise that businesses are finding ways to cash in on the game's popularity using what's known as lures and nearby Pokestops to attract customers. In a few minutes, we'll hear from two Illinois businesses that are doing just that. But first, it's not just businesses, but also libraries, churches, advocacy groups, and other organizations that are capitalizing on the Pokemon Go craze. For example, when a church in Champaign found out they had a Pokestop in their building, they created a church sign reading, "Jesus said, catch them. Pokemon stop here." We'll tweet out a photo of that church sign. But Christopher Schilling of Uniplace Church says they wanted to take it a step further.
And we did that by doing what a lot of other churches have done across the country, by having a Pokemon Go table, where basically we offered free drinks, we offered a charging station, snacks, and chairs, and just the opportunity for people to kind of have conversations with other Pokemon Go players. You would have some people that would automatically see that it's a welcome table, and they would sit down and they would converse with us and get their free drinks and snacks. Others, they looked a little skeptical. I think they were afraid that we were going to pull them in for communion or something of that fact. But, you know, we said, look, we're just here just offering friendship and hospitality to those in the Champaign community who are playing Pokemon Go, no strings attached. And, you know, you're welcome to come to one of our services or do other fun things with our church, but we're just here to make a connection.
That's Christopher Schilling, the Minister for Campus and Community Relations at Uniplace Church in Champaign. He added that Uniplace, quote, looks forward to continuing to be a faith-based Pokestop, which is open and inclusive to all people, no matter who they are or what current level of Pokemon they are on, end quote. Advocacy groups have also incorporated Pokemon Go into some of their political outreach efforts. Next Gen Climate Illinois has hosted several Pokemon Go meetups across the state. The group's press secretary, Katie Cronin, says the idea was a way to connect with young voters.
And so that's our whole goal for Next Gen Climate, is to find out where young people are, get them excited about climate change, because it's something that we've polled people and we've seen that it's something that young people really care about. But young people are also hard to find, and there are also people that don't always come out to vote. And so we wanted to get them and find them where they are, and so that we could have a conversation and get them registered to vote and tell them about what's at stake in this election. And so Pokemon Go allowed us to do that. And so we had about 10 events in Champaign using dropping lures, and we had a couple in Chicago. And so we had a really great turnout and had really great conversations with people who were playing the game. You can tell when people are playing Pokemon because they're always looking at their phone, kind of looking in interesting locations. So our organizers would walk up to them while they were playing the game and start the conversation about climate change, about the importance of voting. And I think it went really well.
That's Katie Cronin of Next Gen Climate Illinois. They have more Pokemon Go meetups scheduled for the upcoming weeks, including one on August 26th in Champaign. You can check out their Facebook page for more information on that. So we've got churches, advocacy groups, and also businesses trying to cash in on Pokemon Go. And we've gotten some Facebook comments about this as well. Jennifer says, my son was out of data and Pokeballs. My solution was to go to a business that had free Wi-Fi and was also a Pokestop. Best mom moment. He was ecstatic, and it worked and brought revenue to the business because we ordered drinks. And Jillian adds, the Smashburger in downtown LaGrange was offering a free item based on your trainer level with any purchase, and Sam's Club was offering a free one-day guest pass and cookie to Pokemon trainers. So businesses are trying to take advantage of this. Joining us now on the line to talk about the business side of things is Brent Murray. He's the owner of Dairy House, an ice cream shop in Rockton, just north of Rockford. Brent, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
One of the things that you've tried to do to bring in players who are wandering around playing Pokemon is to go outside is to drop Pokemon lures near Dairy House. And tell us how that works.
It's pretty neat. We are right next to a library which has the Pokestop, and it coincidentally is kind of in our backyard where our picnic area is, where our customers would sit. So we'll spend a small amount of money to get the lure popped, and it tends to, in the virtual game, puts up a little confetti that says, hey, we are a Pokestop, and then the customers will tend to come by and play and then maybe even have an ice cream cone.
How soon after Pokemon Go launched on the App Store did you start to realize the business potential it could have for your shop?
My initial motivations, I'm a fairly young guy, and I grew up with Pokemon, and knew this kind of virtual game was coming out, didn't know a whole lot about it. So when it did come out, there was a few of the staff that got real excited along with me, and we decided, you know what, we're going to do the best we can to kind of foster this community. And it really only took about 48 hours to see the amount of people that it was drawing in just because we were a Pokestop. We actually, at that point, hadn't even popped any lures. I didn't even know about them. And saw a lot of people coming in and talking about it and looking at their phones, and it was real exciting. So it probably within those next 2 days, I realized, my goodness sakes, we're going to end up meeting a whole lot of people that have never even heard of our ice cream shop.
Does your shop use anything besides the lures to try and attract players?
Yeah, we have the good fortune of our building was built in the 1850s, so it's... While we are a Pokestop in the back, we are a gym where the people compete in the front of the building. So at 10 p.m. when we close, we have a contest that whoever is holding the gym, whoever's the kind of king of the hill that night, gets free ice cream the next day. And then the game has kind of there's a team-based architecture to it, too. And you're either red, yellow, or blue. And there's a bit of pride that goes along with whichever color you picked. And we have a little sticker board that when you come in and you get an ice cream cone, you tell us which team you're on, and we'll give you a sticker, and you get to say, yep, that's who we are, and we're the best.
Very good. I want to bring another person into this conversation. Jared Lukart is on the line with us from Peoria. Jared and his brother created a company called Expedition Go, which so far has hosted two gatherings for Pokemon Go players on the Peoria Riverfront. Jared, welcome to the 21st.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
We certainly heard a lot in the news about businesses like Dairy House, which we've just heard about, utilizing Pokemon Go, but we haven't heard much yet about businesses created out of the craze. Tell us how you and your brother started Expedition Go and what it does.
So it's very interesting how ours happened. You know, we started out as a small Facebook group, just promoting Team Valor, and we realized let's try to get a few people down to gather at a place or location. So on July 13th, this is about a week after the game came out, we said, hey, let's gather these people. Well, we started this on Thursday. On Friday, the next morning, we look at our page and we had over 1,000 people interested or going to the event, and we thought, wow, this is really gone and blown up. You know, how can we continue to improve this? And you know, like the gentleman just said, the team based part of it is really, really what you know, the pride that's involved and everything like that is a great way to try to capitalize off of it. I mean, even so, by Sunday, by the time our event rolled around, we had 2,000 people interested in coming. And then by the actual Sunday, when we looked at the numbers, about 1,500 to 1,800 people showed up, which, you know, was insane for doing it in 4 days for an event that, you know, we completely came back, we got pulled out of nowhere, basically. So, I mean, how we kind of sort of realized how we can make something off of it is by focusing on the teams, essentially. You know, we went and bought beads and, you know, different colored beads and different colored glow sticks, and we also noticed that the phone or the game eats up a ton of battery life, so we bought a bunch of phone chargers and things like that to try to sell at these events. And all of those things sold really well, surprisingly. We didn't sell them for very expensively or anything like that, but we sold all these things just because people want to represent their teams and their color and everything like that. We also tried to provide a ton of fun events like costume contests and different activities, gym takeovers, and the winners of all these things will win prizes and things like that, which I think kept bringing people back to our events. Our second event, we really focused on the team aspect, on which team could beat who. We did this thing called Clash of the Legends, where if you won one of those contests, you also got team, you know, points for your team. So people were super excited about that, and they would come and they would try to compete in all these contests and try to get as many points as they can for their team. And one thing we also did at this event is we bought a ton of shirts and wristbands and things that they could look, you know, they could look the part, you know. So, I mean, we sold out of all of our shirts in the first 2 hours of the event, and that it was a 6-hour event, and then we sold out of all of our hats and our lures within our hats and our plushes and wristbands within the first 20 minutes of being there, which was absolutely crazy for these teams.
Wow. Now, as Brent said earlier, he drops lures near his ice cream shop to help draw in players. Jared, you haven't dropped a single lure at either of your events. Why not?
So that's a very interesting thing. What we found out is that a lure is, it's 99 cents. I mean, you can drop, any person can drop a lure at any place. I think the great thing about the ice cream shop is he said he's got a gym and he's got all these things right in that same area. Certain places like you know, hospitals and stuff have 6 or 7 poke stops all within a couple-minute walking distance. So as a business, if I drop one lure that costs me $1 at a business, I mean, if I'm a customer, I could also just go to the hospital, walk around the outside, and hit 5 or 6 or 7 lures and just drop my own and get a lot more out of it. So one thing we've done is we haven't had to drop a single one, and that's because we say we're going to. By the time we go to drop them, because there's so many lures in the spots or so many Pokestops in the spots we've been at, that they're already filled up by all of the players who are there. So we actually haven't, in the two events we've done that's been several hours, we haven't dropped a single lure. We haven't had to. The customers take care of all that themselves.
Very interesting. Brent, back to you for just a moment here. With the school year starting up, do you think you're going to see a drop in players?
I think a lot has to do with the development team for the game itself, and they have to be recognizing that school is starting up pretty soon, and the kids aren't going to be able to have the 5 to 6 hours per day to walk around and play the game and socialize like they did over the summer. My hope as a game player as well is they kind of utilize the fact that the kids are accumulating all together to roll out the next step in the game, which I think is player versus player combat, which where you take your Pokemon and your buddy's Pokemon and maybe during lunch or recess or something battle the two groups together. We'll see what happens, but I think school will impact it a little bit, yeah.
Oh, sure. And Jared, before we say goodbye, I understand an attendee at one of your events paid top dollar for some merchandise. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah, that was pretty interesting. So like I said, we sold out of all of our shirts fairly quickly within, you know, the first 2 hours. And this gentleman came up and he's like, I promised my wife that I'd buy one of her these shirts. And he said, I'll pay you $40 for one of your shirts. Now, these shirts cost us $6 through bulk orders and things. So to get, I mean, our price was normally $20. So for to get that kind of people interested in being on a team and being that kind of thing is just crazy.
Wow. Very interesting stuff, guys. Brent Murray, owner of Dairy House, an ice cream shop in Rockton, and Jared Lukart, one of the founders of Expedition Go in Peoria. Thank you both of us for being with us today.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, yesterday we played a little music from ZZ Top, who's playing at the Illinois State Fair. That runs through August 21st. Today we'll hear a little Pat Benatar to take us into the weekend. She plays tonight at 7:30 at the State Fair in Springfield. This is Hit Me With Your Best Shot. That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android, All of those links and every other way to contact us via phone, email, or social media is at our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Christine Herman, Philip Kisabika, Sean Newman, and Travis Stancil, with assistance from Ben Thomas Payne. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft, with help today from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in one last time for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.